Hello, this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. My name is Jamie, and I am a producer here on the Fight Back podcast. Our nonprofit's mission is to help you navigate the complex healthcare system and understand your legal rights, options, and opportunities when you encounter problems and obstacles. We want to empower you with the information you need to fight back and get the best possible care. Today is part one in a special two-part series on physician-assisted suicide and medical aid in dying. This is an issue that has been debated the world over. And while we tackle this issue that has many strong opinions from all sides, we want to remind you, our listeners, that we are here to provide information and thought-provoking discussion on all aspects of healthcare and do not encourage particular action or positions on any of our podcasts.
I'm Steve Poisner. On this episode of Fight Back, we welcome our special guest, Dr. Lonnie Shalvison, for an in-depth discussion about medical aid in dying laws in states around the country. Dr. Shalvison, with 29 years as an emergency room doctor, founded Bay Area End of Life Options in 2016, a practice dedicated to terminally ill patients who are considering aid in dying. Lonnie is currently the chair of the national group called American Clinicians Academy on Medical Aid in Dying, where he focuses on advancing the clinical knowledge and practice of aid in dying, including teaching, consulting with other clinicians about their patients, and advocating for best practices in medical aid in dying. Lonnie will educate us on the origins and evolution of medical aid in dying laws, how the process works in practice, what patients need to know about this end-of-life option, the issues surrounding insurance coverage, and more. Let's get started. Lonnie Shalvison, welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite to be here.
So, Lonnie, you know, today's topic is end-of-life options, and you know, there's lots of different names for it out there. You know, people have heard of these various terms, you know, assisted suicide, medical aid in dying, physician aid in dying. From your point of view, what's the right terminology and how you define it?
Yeah, so it's a great question because the language can be confusing and people even say things to us like, you know, I just want the death pill. But to be clear, the language has evolved over time. Back in the 1990s, when this was just beginning with the first law in Oregon, and you all might remember the name Jack Kevorkian, the term was assisted suicide. And rapidly over time, that fell out of favor because really when someone is at the end of their life, and most of, for example, my patients who are using what's now called medical aid in dying, which is taking a medication to end their life as they approach death. And so all of my patients are usually maybe 1 to 2 weeks from dying inevitably and unavoidably by the disease that they have. And so medical aid in dying is not a suicide because suicide refers to when someone has the option of a continued life, but proceeds with ending that life. In medical aid in dying, of course, the person who is terminally ill no longer has the option of living. They're typically weeks from an unavoidable death by their disease, but so they're choosing the method of their rapidly approaching and inevitable death. And so both suicide experts and legal experts and the medical practice now use the term medical aid in dying. And in fact, in life insurance companies, they are prohibited by law from treating medical aid in dying as if it were a suicide. And the word suicide cannot be used legally on the death certificates of people who take medications to die at the end of their life. So we've dropped the term suicide entirely and most commonly used now is medical aid in dying.
I see. Great. So tell us a little bit more about how does this work? So, you know, there's laws in certain number of states that allow for this. What are the safeguards that have been put in place and what are the procedures that a patient would go through?
Yeah, so let's see if I can give a summary of what this is all about. First of all, there are now 10 states plus Washington, D.C. that have legalized medical aid in dying. The practice has been in practice in Europe, in the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Belgium for many, many, many years. Most recently, New Zealand and some states in Australia have come on board. But in the United States, with 10 states and Washington, D.C., about 22% of the population of the United States is now covered by legalized medical aid in dying. So what does this mean? There are rules and safeguards in place. First of all, a patient who is considering medical aid in dying, and note that I use the term considering very, very specifically, because I don't consider a patient comes to me wanting medical aid in dying. They're considering that as many possibilities they have as their inevitable death approaches. And so while they might tell me, oh, I want to take pills to die, really what they're asking for is I want help in having a good and dignified death. And then we explore the various possibilities. So first of all, in order to even enter into this process, the patient must have a terminal illness. That's defined as having a prognosis of less than 6 months to live. That prognosis and the diagnosis has to be confirmed by two independent doctors. So that's one of the safeguards. You can't just go to your doctor and say, I want to die. And the doctor says, sure, I'll help you. There has to be a second independent doctor who confirms everything. Then the patient themselves have to be capable of making their own medical decisions. That is, they have to be mentally clear thinking. They can't be confused, disoriented. Patients with dementia are excluded. And so the patient must have what's called capacity to make medical decisions. They're unable to use a surrogate in this case. So for instance, the decision about all sorts of things can be made by your durable power of attorney or somebody in the family who can make patient requests, make requests for you. That does not apply to medical aid in dying. The request must come directly from the patient. That is another safeguard. The patient must make two separate verbal requests for medical aid in dying, separated by 15 days. So that 15-day waiting period is another safeguard. The two separate verbal requests that made to the physician is another. And then the actual ingestion of medications must be by the patient. We don't start intravenous medications. We don't use any types of injections. These medicines are usually swallowed, although there are some alternatives with feeding tubes. And so this so-called self-ingestion is the way we see the final consent of the patient, meaning the patient must take the medications themselves. So you must be terminally ill. You have to have capacity to make your own medical decisions. You have to have two doctors in agreement. And when all of that falls into place, then patients usually wait until they're quite ill and then make the final decision whether they want to go on to a so-called natural death or death by the disease, or whether usually 1 to 2 weeks before they would otherwise die, they choose to avoid those last final difficult weeks and take medications to die sooner.
Why would a patient choose, you know, medical aid in dying versus you know, doctors now in hospitals, you know, give a lot of morphine, right, in order to make it easier for dying patients to die. How do you compare those various different options here?
Yeah, and you're absolutely correct. What's important to understand here is there are options. There's no one answer to a dignified death. We do not have in the medical aid in dying field. We don't have, you know, to put it this way, a lot of people use the term death with dignity to refer to medical aid in dying, and I fully disagree with that. You can have a dignified death in any way that you want. You don't need medical aid in dying to have a dignified death. As you said, there's hospice care, there's palliative care. Anything that you want that you consider to be dignified is dignified. But so your comparison, for example, roughly there's no contradiction between going into hospice and getting morphine and palliative care and all of that at the end of your life with great success at providing a comfortable and dignified death. Hospice and medical aid in dying work together. In fact, 95% of the patients that I've seen who opt for medical aid in dying are also receiving hospice care at the time, and the hospices are most commonly supportive of the patient's decision. And so this is just one more option. The difference between getting morphine and other sedative medications as you approach death at the very last weeks to days of your death is that if you're doing that, then you usually sort of linger in a confusion or a coma for a number of days to a week or two once you approach getting close to death. And it's that lingering phase where you're lying in bed, unable to move, usually having your family need to do pretty intensive care of changing diapers and taking care of you as you lay in bed and can't get out. Some patients just feel that they don't want to go through that last week or two, and they opt to take medications to die. Rather than being sedated by morphine, they opt to take medications to die and end the process. It's really a question of velocity, speed. With hospice care, the final process of dying can take up to a few days to a few weeks. With medical aid in dying, it takes up to a few minutes to a few hours.
So I suspect a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with the medications here. You just mentioned it takes a few minutes to a few hours. I mean, does it always work? Is there any painful side effects? Tell us more about the medicines here.
Yeah, it's a great question because, I'm the head of the American Clinicians Academy on Medical Aid in Dying, and we have been responsible for a lot of investigation that has improved the medication from the days, 25 years ago when this started in Oregon. It was one medication called Seconal. The time to death varied. You took actually 100 capsules of Seconal. The powders were mixed into a drink, and you had to swallow the medications. And with that, time to death varied from about an hour to over 4 days. And we have so perfected the medication since then that at this point in time, somebody comes and helps you mix the medications. If you're the patient, you don't have to do this yourself. Your family or a professional can be there to mix the medications. They come in a powder. They come up to about 4 ounces of a fairly bitter tasting liquid, but most patients tolerate it quite nicely and they follow it with some sorbet to sweeten their mouths. So you swallow this 4 ounces of medications. Within about 2 to 10 minutes, you enter into a deep sleep, which is compared to surgical anesthesia. We can achieve that anesthesia with the newer medications quite rapidly, about 2 to 10 minutes after you take the medications. And then the average time to death right now is about an hour after you take the medications, you die. We have seen deaths that go up to maybe 5 or 6 hours, but no longer see the days-long deaths before the medications were perfected. So the medications themselves are very, very high doses of morphine and sedatives like Valium, as well as medications to stop your heart once you're asleep.
And after the 2 to 10 minute period, when you initially fall asleep, I mean, then is it a peaceful death after that, even though it might take a few hours?
Yeah, think of surgical anesthesia. At that point in time, once you're deeply unconscious, you are unaware of anything that is passing. You're deeply anesthetized. And so although it might take an hour or two to die, the family is the only one who's witnessing and experiencing that hour or two. For all effects and purposes, your brain is shut off after about 10 minutes or so. The family, on the other hand, might witness some deep breathing, some groaning, some movements of your muscles and twitching. So it's not a death that looks like the fairy tale dove flying out the window, as many people in Hollywood have portrayed this. It's a calm, peaceful passing, no question about that. But death is still death. We haven't been able to change that. And there's still the death rattle. There's still other symptoms. But the patient is unaware of any of that. For the family, it can be upsetting. That's why we recommend that a professional be in attendance if possible, so that we can guide the family through the process and just explain that this patient is deeply anesthetized. It may seem like they're breathing, they're having some breathing difficulty, but they're not aware of it. That's just what death looks like.
And is it 100% effective now?
Yeah, it's 100% effective, depending on how you define effective. Over the years, we've gotten it very, very close to that. There are occasionally, and I'm talking about really, really rare episodes of patients who vomit the medications, and we have to move on to other administrations. But in general, we're probably well at 99.999% effectivity with the oral medications right now.
I see. And I was reading in preparation for this discussion that insurance sometimes covers the costs of these medications and the medical advice and so forth, sometimes not. If you have to pay for this out of pocket, is it expensive?
Well, I wish it were true that insurance may sometimes covers it. It's very rare, actually, that insurance covers it. Here's the thing. In California, especially, this is a practice that is 5 years old. It is, by law, the medications must be paid for if you're a Medi-Cal patient. So if you're poor and on Medi-Cal, the expenses are covered for Medi-Cal. But as of now, this is such a new procedure in medicine that there's no coding. And to clarify for patients who are listening and for families, coding means how the doctor bills the process. So in general, if you're going to be doing this under the auspices of, let's say, your family physician or your oncologist, they'll bill you the same as for an office visit or a home visit. And they'll cover that under a palliative care billing or something like that. So it's rare that a patient pays their private doctor. If you're in hospice care, which is covered by Medicare, then in general, if the hospice is providing the care, this is included in all of your hospice care, although they can't bill Medicare specifically for medical aid in dying because Medicare is a national policy and medical aid in dying is a California and other state law. So the prices and the billing get a bit complex. Most patients do not have to pay for this out of pocket, but some do. And the insurance companies, it is extremely rare to find an insurance company that knows how to pay for this. And patients have tried recouping their expenses. And in general, they have no luck. The fees for private doctors who do this for you, if they do insist on an out-of-pocket payment rather than just billing for office visits or home visits, if they insist on that, the fees vary from $1,000 to about $3,000.
And what about the medications?
The medications cost about $800. They're very expensive because they are compounded by a specific compounding pharmacy, and they're such huge doses of medications. As you can imagine, we're really trying to give doses of medications that are fail-safe. So the medications are about $800. As I said, Medi-Cal will pay for that. That's the most significant expense for most patients and families, is to pay for the medications.
I see. So if someone is interested in this, should they talk to their family doctor or should they search for a specialist?
Well, you know, most family doctors don't yet have much experience with this. Realize that a family doctor, if you look at their practice and they have a few thousand patients, only 1 to 5 of their patients dies each year. And so they rarely get requests for medical aid in dying, and they haven't gained experience at it yet. What I recommend is, of course, you talk to your family doctor or your oncologist or your cardiologist, whoever is responsible for your care, and you ask them if they are willing to participate and if they haven't done it before to learn about it. The American Clinicians Academy on Medical Aid in Dying has a website, acamaid.org, acamaid.org. We have a referral system so that if your personal doctor is not knowledgeable or willing to help you with medical aid in dying, you can contact us at the Academy and we will find you a doctor with experience who can help you with that. And our referral rate is 100%. If you get in touch with us, we will find you a doctor.
Lonnie, I know some of your background is in the ER. I understand you spent 29 years in emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. Why are you so passionate about medical aid in dying?
You know, first of all, I believe really, really strongly in patient autonomy, meaning that patients get to decide about their medical care. And it's clear when you poll the public about whether they support the legalization of medical aid in dying, it's one of the few things that polls consistently over 70%. So this is really something that patients who are dying want access to. They might not necessarily avail themselves of it, but they want the right to make that decision. And so I've always, in the emergency department or wherever I've worked, really believed that patients get to call the shots on how they get medical care and what medical care they want. And especially, I have a lot of experience seeing people die. Especially, I think patients have the right to decide how they die. And so this has been something dear to my heart for a long time. And to give you an interesting comparison, and I say this and many other doctors who now work with medical aid in dying, you know, I spent, as you said, 29 years in the emergency room. I saw a lot of death and I saw a lot of good care and saving of lives. And a lot of patients and their families were very thankful for the work I did. But when I started doing medical aid in dying, I received gratitude and the ability to care closely for patients in a way that I had never been able to do before. The moment of death is an extremely important life moment in life history. And when you help a patient die the way they feel they want to, there is never more gratitude that I've seen and appreciation for the work I've done than with medical aid in dying from families and patients.
Yeah, I think the autonomy argument is super strong. What are the arguments against medical aid in dying? Why would you know, people in the medical profession, you know, want to you know, block this this option for people?
Sure. So it varies from the religious to the pragmatic. The religious argument, especially in amongst Catholics, and there are, realize there are many Catholic health institutions in our state and in this country, and they believe in sort of the redemptive value of suffering, that the process of a so-called natural death, which really doesn't happen in this country anymore, but that process of allowing death to proceed by the way God wants it, there's a quality and you gain something by going through that natural process that you might not otherwise gain if you die a week or two before that process. And so many Catholic institutions, if not all, oppose medical aid in dying on the religious grounds, and those hospital facilities and hospices that are Catholic-based do not participate in this at all with their patients. On the other hand, there's a pragmatic question, which is that, you know, we have yet to provide uniform hospice care for all patients in our state, and that especially is for poor patients and people of color, and that the emphasis on dying should be to get more people into good hospice and palliative care, where we treat their symptoms when we make their deaths better, and this medical aid in dying question is just getting in the way. And I can see that argument, actually, and don't necessarily disagree with it, but I don't see them as a conflict. There's nothing that says that if medical aid in dying is a possibility on your menu of options, that you don't also get hospice and palliative care. In fact, as I said before, about 95% of medical aid in dying patients in my practice were also in hospice, and the average nationally is running about 80%. So I don't see a conflict between hospice and palliative care and medical aid in dying. There was for a while where people in hospices and palliative care thought that medical aid in dying, if their patient asked for medical aid in dying, it meant that they had failed them. And that's really, really now understood not to be true. Medical aid in dying is a choice a patient makes, not a failure of the doctor's abilities.
Is it possible that, you know, predicting when someone's actually going to die, is that still, you know, hard to be super precise? Is there a possibility of just, you know, mistakes being made in terms of, you know, how terminal the patient might be?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it turns out in pragmatics, strangely, to be irrelevant. It is really true what you just said. Deciding whether someone has less than 6 months to live and therefore qualifies for the law is an imprecise practice. The idea that you can tell whether somebody has less than 6 months to live or 8 months to live is really something we don't have great ability for. But the reason that that's not important is that if, let's for example say that we're wrong and a person who has less than 6 months to live really has 9 months to live, well, that person maintains relatively good health for a longer time. And I have never seen a patient out of about 400 requests that I've worked with, I've never seen a patient who is still healthy who decides I'm going to take the medications tomorrow. What happens is that if we're wrong about a prognosis and the patient really has 9 months to live, well, then it's 9 months later that they take the medications. Our patients who decide the date to actually take medications to die are quite ill. There's no debate when somebody is 2 to 3 weeks from death. We all know that. But distinguishing between 6 months to 9 months, of course, that's a lot more difficult. But in terms of safety and pragmatics, if you really have, even I've seen some patients who, because their treatment suddenly kicks in, we thought they had 6 months to live. One patient with pancreatic cancer I know who lived for 3 years. She was a patient of mine. But she, of course, didn't, when she was doing so well with treatment, suddenly say she wants medications to die. And so she was quite sick and definitely dying. By the time she took the medications, she probably had maybe 1 or 2 weeks to live. So it's a great question. You're correct that prognosis is an imprecise science, but it turns out not to be relative to the practice of medical aid in dying when we actually do it.
Right. Are you concerned about abuse by insurance companies? I mean, do they save money by promoting medical aid in dying as compared to what might be the more traditional approach?
Yeah, you know, that applies to a lot of things. Insurance companies save money if they convince you to stop chemotherapy for breast cancer. Insurance companies save money if they take you off of ventilators. Just those abuses are always promulgated and always theoretical. And nobody's documented cases where an insurance company has encouraged a hospital to take you off the ventilator because your ICU care becomes too expensive. And it doesn't apply to medical aid in dying. In fact, as I said before, insurance companies have barely caught on to the reality of medical aid in dying. They don't cover it, and therefore they don't have much of a role in this. But of course, in a system where there isn't national health care, in a system where there's an advantage to insurance companies and others to have people die sooner, we don't see a whole lot of abuses by insurance companies who say, we're not going to cover your breast cancer chemotherapy because we want you to die sooner. It just really doesn't happen pragmatically. It's something that the opposition throws at us a lot, and it's really not valid.
Right. Why is the American Medical Association still opposed?
The American Medical Association tends to lag about 10 to 20 years behind the reality of many things. They're still opposed because they still see this as if it's a failure of doctors, that doctors should be able to keep people alive and make them comfortable. They use this theoretical interpretation that doctors are lifesavers and not life takers. And I can see sort of the nice poetry of that. But in reality, doctors are people who should be responding to patients' autonomous requests for how they want to die. And it's not to be seen as a failure of the doctor if the patient wants to die 2 weeks sooner. It's to be seen as the patient's own personal decision. The American Medical Association tends to do what's best for doctors, not necessarily for patients.
Right. Understood. So, Lonnie, is there an example or two that you can describe, naming names, of people who turned out to be great candidates for aid in dying versus others that might not be great candidates?
Sure. Let me paint you a picture. A patient of mine who was a car mechanic all of his life. Developed a rare skin cancer and died from that only after the skin cancer had invaded his spine and was about to cause a severe paralysis that might suddenly cause him to have severe respiratory distress and die fairly uncomfortably from that. He was my patient for probably 4 months, and during that 4 months, we spent a lot of time talking about what would be the criteria for when he's ready to die. And his main criteria was when he couldn't get out of bed and walk his dog and work on his motorcycle and was confined to bed, he would then be ready to take medications to die. And as it turned out, with many of my patients, they establish that rule and then they break it. So it turned out that when he found out that he was confined to bed and barely able to move, and this was 4 months after he first thought he would take the medications, but my job is to make a patient comfortable for as long as possible and to avoid medications to die as long as possible. So I worked with him, and he went on to the point where he realized, I can lay in bed and still watch football games and with my family, and that's okay. I'll accept that. But when he got to the point where he was so paralyzed he was barely able to move by his cancer, he had us move his bed to his garage where he worked on cars and put the hospice bed, he was in hospice as well, up on a jack. And sort of hover above his motorcycles and cars while he took medications to die. He was probably only a week or so from death, and he had designed the death that felt the most appropriate for him, floating in his garage above his motorcycles and the cars he had worked on. And he took medications to die and died within about 40 minutes with his family all around him. So first, he had taken it to the point of logic where he just couldn't go on anymore. And that point was probably 4 months later than he ever thought it was, because we provided good palliative and hospice care along the way. And then he finally died the way he wanted. So that's not an atypical case. People, that's fairly well how it usually works.
Right. You mentioned the Netherlands earlier. In the Netherlands, the laws there, if I understand it correctly, have more flexibility. How do you feel about medical aid in dying for people who aren't necessarily terminal ill, but they may be, you know, paralyzed or wheelchair bound, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm going to take that question on, and it will sound like a dodge, but hopefully it won't be. I work as a doctor where I work with what the public allows me to do. And the public and the legislatures, and in a democracy, that's how we work, have given me the ability to work with certain restrictions about how we do medical aid in dying in California and the United States. And I, as a clinician working individually with patients, I work within the legal and ethical parameters that our public has been willing to give me. And so I can look at the Netherlands and I can look at other places, but they're kind of irrelevant. I take care of patients day to day, and I work within the parameters of ethics and medical practice that we have decided here in my community that is how we should do it. We're not the Netherlands. And so I tend not to comment very much on those other situations because I want to work with patients who work with me in the framework in which we work here in my state.
Got it. You also mentioned Dr. Jack Kevorkian a little bit earlier. Sure. So net, did he end up having, you know, a positive impact on the movement that you're involved with? How would you assess that?
Well, certainly mixed. First of all, I think that Jack Kevorkian was an unethical physician doing some crazy things at a time in the early 1990s. When he was sort of driving around, didn't get to know his patients, didn't provide palliative care, didn't have them involved with other medical care, and he just started IVs and helped them die. I don't think that's the way it should work. That said, Jack Kevorkian and the way he did it was very attention grabbing in the media. And so people started thinking about this and talking about how they might die at their dinner tables. And he opened up the conversation in the entire country about how medical aid in dying might be something people want. But he, as an individual practitioner, I think he did a terrible job. So it's quite mixed. Fortunately, we've moved way past Jack Kevorkian to the point of good medicine, best practices in medical aid in dying, and end-of-life care. And what we at the Academy try to promulgate has got nothing to do with Jack Kevorkian. We try to promulgate really good end-of-life care with one possible option, that's medical aid in dying, but it's only one of many options. What we are really in favor of is people make their own decisions about how they want to die.
Lonnie, do you know approximately how many people opt for medical aid in dying in the United States or in California?
Nobody knows. I can tell you how many people have completed it, which is a very different question. So roughly in California, a couple of thousand people have completed medical aid in dying. Across the country, it's a few thousand more. And those relatively small numbers of the patients who die more reflect the lack of access to medical aid in dying, which is patients who ask their doctors if they want to participate. And the doctor usually says, I don't know anything about this. It's new. I can't help you. And then the patients who are quite sick drop the issue because it's just so hard to find a doctor. That's why we at the Academy have started our referral system. And so the number of patients who might want this option, or as I said before, consider medical aid in dying, I think is extremely, extremely high compared to the number of patients who complete the process and take medications to die. But we don't know those numbers because by definition, those are patients who don't find anybody to talk to about it and then just go on and get otherwise good palliative care at the end of their life, but don't continue to pursue medical aid in dying because it's just too complicated and hard right now. We are working to make that easier, but the number of people who complete it is vastly under the number of people who consider it.
Right. Well, one final question here. So if one of our listeners is considering this option, medical aid in dying, or they know someone who might want to consider it, what do you recommend as the best place for them to start? Where should they dig in to get more information? What are your recommendations?
Sure. You know, there are a number of, you can Google medical aid and I and come up with a number of organizations, and I'll put in the plug for ours. We are the only organization that isn't just a political and advocacy organization, but really works on best practices with clinical care and helping doctors and patients who are seeking medical aid and dying. And so the American Clinicians Academy on Medical Aid and Dying, we have lots of information on our website. We also have the only really functioning patient-to-doctor referral system that's national. And so they can come onto our website, fill in our intake form, and we will have experts in medical aid and dying, and I'm talking about clinical experts, contact them and find out their needs and help them with it.
Very good. And before we sign off, is there any other key aspect to this important topic that you'd like to mention?
You know, I think, again, to emphasize that we are one small part of a community of clinicians who provide end-of-life care. I think we're an important part. I think we're a growing part. But really, to emphasize the fact is that the only way to have a good death is not by medical aid and dying. Sometimes people get fixated on, I'm at the end of my life, I'm going to take medications to die. And I'd highly recommend that you kind of think this through and wait and see how your death evolves. For most people, death evolves just fine. I don't want us to become part of the fear of death industry that does exist in this country. And I want us to think about death as you have many ways to have a dignified death. Think them through carefully as your death evolves. And one of those possibilities is medical aid and dying, but it's just one of many possibilities. We don't have a monopoly on good deaths. Wait until you see how you're dying and then make some good decisions with a lot of information.
Dr. Lonnie Shalveson, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
You're very welcome. It's really been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
I want to thank you for listening to today's Fight Back podcast. Our mission is to provide you with the healthcare resources and information in a refreshing and interesting format. I also want to thank Lonnie for joining us and providing our listeners with highly informative view into medical aid and dying. For more information, please visit our website at www.healthcareconsumerrights.org. While on our website, you can check out additional podcasts or access more information and resources to help you navigate our healthcare system and get the care you deserve. We also welcome your input and stories that we can use on future podcasts. This is Steve Poizner, and this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. Thanks for listening. I look forward to our next podcast. Talk with you soon.